welcome Jack, welcome Rachel.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi everybody. Thank you for being here with us tonight for the live recording of the Faber Poetry podcast. If you're all avid and dedicated listeners, you'll know that we always really deeply prepare for these podcasts. So we've got lots of really amazing surprises and guests and poems and chat for you this evening. And maybe we need to, well, kick off by introducing ourselves. My name's Rachel Allen.
I'm Jack Underwood. And you're listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
Oh, of course.
Are you playing the tune?
I haven't got the tune.
Oh, usually there's a tune that goes down, down, down.
Yeah.
So don't. I'll just not do the rest of it, but yeah.
We'll keep that in.
Okay.
Yeah. So normally we start with a... with a poetry, what do they call?
Postcard.
Audio postcard. But we thought, because we're actually out of the studio, we should, and we're live, we should do a live postcard from here to the podcast.
That makes sense. And to everyone. Yeah.
And to everyone. And one of the groups of people that I realised were a little underrepresented on the podcast, audio postcard bits, was dead people. Faber published loads of dead people, and we had not really tapped into this resource. If you are a dead person listening to the podcast, I'm just going to say it's not too late, maybe. Shoot your shot. But it does come, wanting a dead person on the podcast does obviously involve some material barriers, some logistical problems.
Unless you're doing a seance.
Unless you're doing a seance. In fact, we have the, I think we've mentioned before that the ghost of Elizabeth Bishop is like...
Oh, she haunts the
podcast. But what can you do when you want a dead poet to be here, where you get somebody to read their work for them? And we are very lucky. Like, outrageously... It's an outrageous luxury, really, to have a special guest to read it. So, ooh, a clue, okay? Our special guest has fought a Terminator, whizzed through the fabric of space-time, defeated an army of the dead, and also, I googled this, also holds the status of Super Skrull, making her the most powerful character in the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe. Her electric West End debut as Nina in Jamie Lloyd's production of Chekhov's The Seagull was lauded as hypnotic and irresistible. And she's also the founder of Same You, an amazing charity which supports people recovering from brain injury. And tonight she's going to be reading Charlotte Mew's poem, The Trees Are Down. So please welcome our special guest, Amelia Clark. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, everyone.
Now, I saw on the internet that you do a really good Californian accent, but I'm not going to insist you do that.
Don't make me do that.
No, I would.
But I mean, I could. It would just sound very different.
Maybe we'll do an outtakes at the end or something. But yeah, so Charlotte Mew, The Trees Are Down. Do you want to... Go for it.
Yeah, should I crack on?
Yeah.
Do you want me to do it into the microphone?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you need to do it in the microphone. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a podcast, isn't
it? Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So professional.
Hello, everyone. Good evening. Right. The Trees Are Down by Charlotte Mew. And he cried with a loud voice, saying, "Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees." Revelation. They are cutting down the great plane trees at the end of the gardens. For days there has been the grate of the saw, the swish of the branches as they fall, the crash of the trunks, the rustle of trodden leaves, with the whoops and the whirs, the loud common talk, the loud common laughs of the men above it all. I remember one evening of long past spring, turning in at a gate, getting out of a cart, and finding a large dead rat in the mud of the drive. I remember thinking, alive or dead, a rat was a godforsaken thing. But at least in May that even a rat should be alive. The week's work here is as good as done. There is just one bough on the roped bowl in the fine grey rain, green and high and lonely against the sky. Down now. And but for that, if an old dead rat did once for a moment unmake the spring, I might never have thought of him again. It is not for a moment the spring is unmade today. These were great trees. It was in them from root to stem. When the men with the whoops and the whirs have carted the whole of the whispering loveliness away, half the spring for me will have gone with them. It is going now. And my heart has been struck with the hearts of the plains. Half my life it has beat with these, in the sun, in the rains, in the March wind, the May breeze, in the great gales that came over to them across the roofs from the great seas. There was only a quiet rain when they were dying. They must have heard the sparrows flying and the small creeping creatures in the earth where they were lying. But I, all day, I heard an angel crying. Hurt not the trees.
Thank you. Thank you. So Charlotte Mew, late 19th century, I think. The first thing that struck me about this poem was that it's a rhymer. It's a really sneaky rhyming poem. You don't notice it because of the long line. So the longer the line, the more you can smuggle the rhymes in. But and I just thought that was kind of like, I like how subtle that is. That it's not really, it's not like landing heavily.
Yeah, the rhyme feels built in.
Yeah.
Can I be heard? I'm so loud, so maybe I can just scream my head off, but I can be heard, can't I?
I think so, yeah, cool. And you can be heard on the mic, my mic, yeah. I think
I
so.
Feel like so much of a tree hugger that this poem... And I hadn't actually even read this poem before, and I don't know if it's quite famous, The Trees Are Down.
But I've never heard of it.
Really?
I don't think it's that famous, no. I mean, I suppose Mew is now famously underrated or not talked about, or... Yeah.
I feel like it's so prophetic when she says something like, unmake the spring. I was saying to Jack that I feel like we're living through this period of time where the seasons are making us feel so dislocated from what we have historically experienced. And to have this kind of proto-eco poem position that dislocation from this very material sense of losing an ecological space that makes someone feel so grounded and so rooted and so normalised.
Mm.
Just feels really sad and really moving. And I was thinking about Rachel Carson as well, Silent Spring, these kind of very visionary female thinkers who were able to perceive what was happening ecologically and be so lucid in presenting that long before sort of our contemporary language of the Anthropocene and ecological loss.
But it's also a very sort of, I think as much as it speaks to that kind of like wider predicament or problem, it's also like a very personal situated poem, isn't it? About like that tragic thing of watching trees coming down.
How does it feel to read?
Beautiful, it feels so mournful.
Mm.
It feels like, well, as I was telling you guys before, I'm a country girl, and near me, where my mum lives at the moment, where I grew up from the age of 13, there's this incredible walk that we go on, and it's lined with all of these really old, really beautiful trees, and they all recently just got cut down. The estate kind of deemed it necessary, and we just howled. It was visceral, seeing these things. I mean, my mum was just mouthing off all of these poor guys who were just doing their job, and we were like, what are you doing? But it was, I felt so close to this poem and these words because I was raised with these trees, and
And I think when you've got something, when your landscape is constant and yet kind of unseen because you're so used to it, as soon as that thing is removed, be it a building or nature, it feels huge. It feels like such a kind of monumental shift in your world. And it kind of makes you see everything differently, and the transformation of landscapes. I just think it's really, for me anyway, it feels primal.
Yeah, when you see it. Isn't it?
It's really visceral. And that's, she's done such a beautiful job of within her choice of language and the way that the I'm sure I read it wrong, but the way that it kind of sounds when you're saying it out loud, you feel that loss, and you feel that kind of jagged, like the different thoughts, this lovely rat that you love so much.
I do love the rat. Yeah, the rat really steals the show.
Really does. Well, it's the, you know, it's a very, like, clear image.
Yeah, well, I sort of like, there is, just finding a big rat, a big dead rat.
Well, that's very country as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very London as well.
And very London. It brings us together.
It does. It really does.
But the thing, and it's a fine, I loved just the description of a large rat.
Yeah, not a small one. Yeah. Because it could be a mouse then.
It's a big fat rat in the mud of the drive. And I remember thinking, alive or dead, a rat was a godforsaken thing. And they are like, you know, they're bigger. I think what I love about this poem is actually how the things are bigger than they are when they're dead or different. Like, we had a massive eucalyptus tree fall over in our garden, and what shocked me was actually the size of it. You get used to seeing things standing up, and suddenly a tree's on the floor, and you're like, oh my God, this is, like, massive. It's like a beast, like a dinosaur. It felt like a dinosaur had been, like, felled, you know, had been killed. Yeah, like a whale. And it's the same with, like, I don't know, when you see a dead rat, because you get to have a look at it, and you're like, oh, do you know what? They're quite big, aren't they? And
they move quite fast, to be fair.
They do.
You're now conscious of the size of them.
Their tails are, like, as thick as your finger, and they're, you know, muscular.
They get a bad rap, though, rats.
Well, this one gets, I guess, somewhat...
She's not a fan, I sense.
What does she say? But even in May, at least a rat should be alive.
Yeah.
Not the godforsaken thing. And then it comes back, and, like... if it wasn't for the rat dying, she might never have thought of him again.
Mm.
You know, so maybe, I don't know.
Well, size and realisation seems to factor quite a lot into this, because there's the men sort of laughing and whooping above the trees as they're being cut down, and then there's that zooming into the minutiae or the not-so-minutiae shape of the dead rat, and then it comes back out of it, and it feels kind of global with spring being unmade. And I feel like there's this kind of zooming in and out, which I think the best eco-minded, eco-critical work does. It kind of encapsulates the minutiae and the intimate and the interior with a larger, global, more epic... Well, it sort of complicates or problematizes how we perceive things, which is what I feel like she's doing here with size and mastery and humans and animals and landscape. It feels very zoomy.
I think the zooming is also time as well as space, because it starts like in media res, is that the term? They are cutting down, present tense, they're cutting down the great plane trees.
Which is interesting with the title, because the trees are down.
Yeah.
Mm.
They are cutting down the great... There's like a movement between what has been definitively... what has definitively happened back to the occasion of the happening.
And then she hauls in one evening. I remember one evening of last spring, and that's where the rat belongs.
Mm.
The rat's not really actually in the poem at all. He's a memory of a rat. And then the week's work here is good as done. So suddenly, like, it's shifted. And then at the end, it's going now. And my heart has been struck with the hearts of the plains. Half my life. It's just, like, constantly... dilating this time.
Here's the book for anybody who'd like to buy these beautiful selected poetry and prose.
Yeah.
Because I'm keeping an eye on the time, and as much as I'd like to carry on talking about you and trees, got a couple of other guests.
We do. I think it's one. It's what I love about the poem as well is that it's just sort of like, as much as the rat is the thing that I think about now, what I think about this poem. As you may have gathered, it's my preoccupation with this. But I think it does kind of like, it's rewarding. It goes, every time you read it, there's a different thing you notice. like just the fact they're plane trees and stuff like that. You had to sort of had to look them up.
Mm. They're the ones that make everybody really allergic. Mm. Here, aren't they?
Yeah, with the big, they've got dangly sort of bauble frondy yeah. bits, and the sort of camo mm. design bark. It's very anthropocene.
Not all trees camo designed.
I guess so. Yeah.
Camouflage is inherently an ecological.
That's I know.
So complicated that it's used.
I've really anthropocened myself, haven't I? I have. Yeah, great. And also, like, we're talking about that movement of time and space. I'm thinking, like, around this time it's written, we're getting the beginnings of, like, general theory of relativity, I mm. think, or getting to that stage. Proto-modernism, mm. proto-eco-poem.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Thank you so much for
Thank
reading
you
it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So welcome. So it was a special. Joy. Thank you. Thanks
and you get to take
me.
This away with you.
Lucky
yeah,
me.
I know.
Thanks, guys.
No one leaves
so
our podcast.
Thank you. Round of
applause. Thank you.
Where are
we going to be? Down there.
Doing the stairs?
Yeah,
amazing.
And then you can, if you can,
fabulous.
Yeah.
We have more guests.
Thank you. Thank you.
I feel like I'm on a game show with this.
With the mic. We were saying
I just
it's...
keep bringing people out. Who's next? Well, we actually know who's
yeah,
next.
Yeah, we do know who's
Would
next.
Would you like to join us?
Yeah.
Public guests.
Well, we... Look, in total silence, just so it's really strange. They don't exist until we've introduced them formally. That's the
way of it.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
How did you Hi. Enjoy that poem?
Very much. Yeah. So I wanted to sit in this chair.
You want to sit?
No, but you have it. You.
No.
I'm going to guess the wrong. I want to, because Amelia Clark was sitting there. I want to sit in that chair.
I see.
I have many jokes that can't be said. But sure, you want to?
No. Yeah. Maybe we can, should we? Perform switching throughout the no.
You can do what you want.
Yeah, you can. I mean, this is your show.
We'll introduce you then.
Yeah, yeah. I think they've introduced themselves so well.
If you introduce Aishin,
I will.
I'll introduce.
I don't need your mic. I want to steal it off you, but I don't. I'm already mic'd up. Right. Aishin Hutchinson was born in Port Antonio, Jamaica. He is the author of the poetry collections Far District, winner of the Penn Joyce Osterweil Award for Poetry, and House of Lords and Commons, which received the National Book Critics Circle Award in Poetry. He is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Joseph Brodsky Rome Prize in Literature, the Whiting Award, and a Donald Wyndham Sandy M. Campbell Literature Prize, among others. Aishin also has the greatest honour of all, I think, really, which is to be the very first poet to be back on the podcast, having been a previous guest. So surely that's the summit of anyone's career. Please welcome Aishin.
Thank you. I thought you had said that and leave it there.
We also have Oluwaseun Olayiwola, who is a poet and a critic, who was a part of the Ledbury critic scheme. I am his editor, so I'm going to talk a little bit about his incredible forthcoming collection called Strange Beach, which will be here in 2025. Strange Beach is a lyrically accumulative, internationally reaching, globally minded document that reaches inside bodies, minds, relationships, language, to culminate in a deeply feeling, deeply felt book of dynamic moving work. It's coming in 2025, and we're going to hear some poems from it this evening, which I'm really happy about. But first, Aishin is going to read a few poems for us from his new collection, School of Instructions, which is absolutely phenomenal. And I think it was published yesterday. Was it yesterday? Thursday. Okay.
Today in the States.
Okay, congratulations. That's amazing. Yeah, it's an extraordinary book, and I was lucky enough to hear you read some poems from the collection last night. And I've been thinking a little bit about the commingling narratives within the... I guess it's a long poem, actually, more than a sort of selection of poems. And the sound sense that you bring through, the characters that emerge throughout the book. And I wondered if you wanted to read us a few poems that might exemplify the narrative that runs through, and also the incredible dexterous stuff you do with language and sound and play.
Okay, thanks for that, friend Rachel. It's really nice to be back and to see you both and to be here with you. I didn't plan what to read. I think Rachel, I was hoping you would have specific ideas and I would just follow through. So what I'll do then is probably just open the book randomly and read this page, these two pages.
56 and 57, those of you with the book.
Okay. But I'm just going to switch. pages 56 and 57. You will hear a few things, one of which is the name of a boy, Godspeed, which is the name of a boy who is the central character in this book. And Godspeed is just his nickname. We don't know his real name. And he's a 12-year-old boy. He becomes 13 later in the book. He lives in the rural Jamaica in the 1990s. And he lives mostly with his grandmother, who appears in this part of the book. But you'll also hear other names, names of places, place names, which are place names in rural Jamaica, but also place names in the Middle East, because this book concerns West Indian soldiers who were volunteers in British regiments in World War I, in mostly in the Middle East. They fought all over, or were they also were in Europe doing the things that we know all World War I soldiers did in the trenches and so on. But they saw combat mostly in the Middle East. So the book is sort of concerned with their experience in that region. Mm. On moonless nights, he saw through the pale leaves of the coral caladium his grandmother's potted heart's desire lining a ledge of the veranda, praying that they would sprout into books by R.L. Stevenson and Archie Comics, lit up by his jam jar of blinky blink fireflies ticking between the disheveled pages, quailing with the morning mist. Tra la 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 la. Private L. Kildare B. Boy died from dysentery in Hebron. Godspeed also had a severe bout of congenitis malaise, which trembled his hands searching through the thorn bush fence for Rosalie's fingers. Extra karmic deposit. The boy fell asleep in the merciless shade of the schoolyard cherry tree. It was at this time, at the year's end, 91-91, Private J. Mitchell was shot by order of Field General Court Martial. His soul fled to Midian accordingly. So Godspeed is always reading his a volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which he stole from the school library. His school is called Happy Grove. And in his Britannica, he found another Blue Mountains in Australia, other than the ones behind his grandmother's house. Filled with jealous rage, he tore out the entry page and stuffed it in Horace's mouth. Blinky Blink strummed the dark back of his mind in Judea. B-Boy proceeded from Ramleh to Yebna by march route. Then the battalion proceeded to Sharkia Es Garbea by march route through fig trees and apricot trees and almond trees. Surreptitious mosquitoes by the billions. Anopheles bearing the king's messenger bag on a branch from Rafa, which was bombed to Shellal, which was not, where Godspeed had a votary of his own. For dinner, he ate Eldorado's ackee and shat in the piratical patch of pure blue water across from his house. Should I just read one more?
Yeah.
One more page? So here is
page 71.
Thank you.
Maybe I could explain one word that you'll hear, which is a Jamaicanism. I'm not too sure. You might recognize it. When somebody cuts school, in Jamaica you say skull school, meaning you don't show up. So that word is being used in that context in the opening part of this poem. Godspeed, skulled elocution day at Happy Grove, and so miss the shrieking out of, and then my heart with pleasures fills and dances with the daffodils. Bayonet fighting amid the cactus hedges, the metal tangled with the sand's imperfect memory in the wood of Ephraim. He sprinkles spikenard on his head and replenishes jam jar of fireflies as if they were gold coins of fluctuating bullions in the deep dark of night. He was called to whitewash the walls of prestige funeral supplies and service by the seaside in Port Antonio, where his grandmother's body was laid out for the final burial rites. He decreed a calendrical change, and her laminated almanac savior was taken off the kitchen wall. He heard the far-off drum of Miriam as he paced with a sharp ringing in his ears among his grandmother's croton plants, which glittered like sardius, like topaz, like diamond, like beryl, like onyx, like jasper, like sapphire, like emerald, like carbuncle, like gold, like a green, ringing green of mildewed croton leaves he would, if he could, scatter on the turquoise sea.
This book is just so extraordinary. I feel like it's one of the best, it's definitely one of the best books of poetry I've read this year, if not for a long time.
Thank you.
And as you introduced it earlier, you talked briefly about the kind of, I suppose, intersecting, interlocking, interweaving narratives or modes that make up the book.
Yeah.
The experiences of West Indian volunteers in British regiments during the First World War, and this incredibly irreverent, sort of very, almost cute and strange narrative of Godspeed, the schoolboy who's living in Jamaica in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I feel like with the commingling of these two narrative forces or narrative trains, you build this allegorical, kind of mythological feeling of a world that feels quite recognisable, but then is also something that is particular to the histories that you're speaking through and speaking to. And just from a practical sense, I was wondering how you brought these modes together, because there is archival work, there are statistics that weave their way through the book, and there is this very secure narrative that runs through, not from Godspeed's perspective, but definitely we move with him and follow him in his orbit as he navigates and negotiates family and landscape and people. And putting all of this into such a cohesive and gripping long poem, actually such a masterful long poem, I was just in awe of how you managed to bring these things together, and I wanted to talk to you about that, the sort of commingling of narratives and the framework of the book as a whole.
Thanks for that question, for framing it that way. I'm pleased that it came across as such to you. It's a big question, and I'm trying to think the best way to tackle it and not go on and on. I think the first thing I would say is the poems that I love, that I return to, inspired me and taught me a lot, pointed me into ways that I could think about creating this poem. And one such poem is David Jones, in parentheses. which is a book-length poem about one day in the Battle of the Somme, 1915, I think it is set, just one day, but it's, I don't know, maybe 200 pages long. And it's a mixture of different styles of writing, short lyric passages, long prose passages, and there's a sort of jarring effect in which these things are combined. Mm. But there are several characters and many voices that stream through. Mm. And it's a difficult poem to read, and at first reading it's very confusing because it's very difficult to make sense of what is happening. But I don't think Jones is concerned too much, if I may sort of presume, about our understanding of the narrative as such. I think he was interested in communicating a texture of what an experience might have felt like, and wanted to make a reader, a listener, a hearer sort of relive such an experience. And so for me, a poem begins in its rhythmic, textural formation. And that's a very sort of mysterious place, because where does rhythm come from? Mm. You know, I grew up in a landscape overlooking, in a hill overlooking the sea, and I feel that is part of my own rhythmic shape in that vantage of that perspective. And then watching the water and its movement. But once you, in the context of a Caribbean person, looking at a landscape, it's innocent, it's beautiful. But if you think for a moment about the history and your own place in that history, it becomes very complex. So the beauty is then complicated. So that's what this poem tries to do. It tries to hold on to the double experience of trying to communicate as much of the archival work that I did with the natural landscape of the Jamaica that I know, collapsing those two things into one. So a lyric is simultaneity.
That thing of what... when you're reckoning with kind of history and geography and experience, I think that so often, when we think about history, we tend to think about the facts of the matter or to present a kind of linear version of events. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, why would anyone try to write a poem that would compete with precisely that kind of mode of thinking? Whereas the real strength of a poetic enterprise is the fact that it can hold dissonance and it can hold contradiction, or it can be in the 1990s and in the early 20th century at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it kind of like, I can only imagine that you sort of have to start somewhere and then sort of get lost of it.
Exactly. You begin somewhere. And again, it's a sort of pre-verbal beginning, because you hear it, you try to figure out what the words might be to fill that vacuum of rhythmic pressure, because you're only you have to resort to words, and so on. So, yeah. But I want to say something very practical in response, that the poem came as a commission. To respond to, you know, the archival material in 2018 because of the centenary of the war. So I had a beginning place to just think about this and try to write movingly about it.
Do you think you would have got there without that commission? Because I always feel like when you're commissioned to do something, often it's out of need, financial necessity, or just kind of like. And sometimes you can feel like, oh God, the last thing I want to write a poem about is like,
I've been forced to write a poem.
But then it can actually kind of, in order to sort of accommodate it in your own poetic, you have to kind of get busy and think and think differently. And
that's why it took 7 years.
Oh, wow. How did they feel about that from the commission?
Did you make
the deadline?
Yes, I made it. You know, I wrote something, and then, but I was so, and it's a sort of maybe a little bit overused word, but I was very haunted by what I had discovered in the archives, and I felt I had to do justice to that material. And so I kept, the poem didn't want to release me, so I had to sort of live with it for for a couple of years. Mm.
David Jones makes so much sense to me, actually, thinking about in parentheses, because it's so ephemeral.
Yes.
There's so much kind of different kinds of material, pictorial matter, textual play, and the format and formatting of this book is so stunning, and its kind of pseudo-chaptered nature, which makes the kind of mythological fable feelings sort of propel even further. And your language play in the book is just so fantastic. There's this kind of repetitious mode that you fall into, and a kind of tonal irreverence that feels very specific to the histories that you're writing into and about, and these fantastic nicknames and references that you have woven through that...
And the music, the singing.
Which... I heard quite a bit from last night, and it's just such a fantastic bringing together of all these different sort of forms and ephemeras.
Does it feel playful to you?
I hope it feels playful to someone who encounters it. I had fun at some point after, because I think that once you're in the mire of the poem, you're uncertain about how it's, where it's going to get, because you work on several drafts, you destroy them, you salvage what you can, right? But then the characters start to become really funny in their own voicing, because then and there are a lot of, for instance, I my own personal sort of, the best fun I had was creating these puns. There are a lot of veiled puns. Some friends who read drafts didn't discover them, and which is painful because I realize that my friends aren't that smart.
I always find that a delightful revelation myself.
Right.
So, Jack's really good at puns. He'll get them. Yeah.
Oh, well, we should have a pun off.
You'd do that.
Maybe.
I'm not good at puns.
We have to set it up properly. I'm not just going to launch into it now.
Go.
No, but yes, the playfulness, I think, not just in the bits of when characters speak, but the way that, because it's mostly not in lines. It's the sort of short prose forms throughout, which is difficult to actually emulate a pun with that style. So I had to figure out how to get the texture again in a sort of punning way, but sort of maintaining the integrity of the elegiac feel that the poem is, the mode of that eulogizing frame that the poem is mostly trying to put forward.
Mm. I think the reason I asked was because I actually... when I'm reading your so luscious language, I actually feel it's dead serious, not as dead serious as in without without pleasure, but words, especially adjectives, particularly that I've never seen in my life here. And with another poet, I might feel like, oh, well, you're just showing off. Mm. Whereas when I read, there are just so many good adjectives in it that it doesn't feel like a game. It feels like this is the only way in which this can be described to you. And so that's why I asked if it was playful, because I was like, even though there is a linguistic play, it feels as if it just feels so, the kind of expanses, the edges of language you go to are like the only way in which this could come, transmit to us. Mm. And there's something very serious about like these almost words that feel as if they're from a completely different time.
Hmm.
feels like it has its own dictionary. That's what I was thinking. These sort of, and within that, there's a kind of theatrical.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot my mic. There's a kind of theatrical aspect to it as well.
There's the encyclopedic as well, which keeps on. It feels encyclopedic by like these words, as if you like. Which I'm just assuming these are words you have off the dome, but like, you know, if there's this encyclopedic feel to it that just doesn't feel like it was for fun or just to say you needed a pizzazz. It doesn't feel like pizzazz.
Mm. Or nerdery, you know, there's nothing that without sort of an nerdery, like nerdy. Something that's just like,
God forbid.
Well, no, but you know,
we're up here talking about poetry.
Okay, within a reasonable within the schema of nerd.
Well, I want to defend the nerds and the nerdy readers of poetry who read against the grain of you know, you're told to read. You know, you're given certain poets, and you're told that that those are the poets you should read. I think yes, do it, but also. Become an autodidact who reads wildly, who reads in ways that would surprise others, that, oh, you read that. Mm. Sometimes I actually read just for that reason. when someone says, you know, because they have certain presumptions about you. Mm. So, and then I'm like, well, you know what, I'm into so-and-so, and it's always a blank stare, which I relish, you know. So.
Would you like to do a little reading?
Yes. Yeah.
Bring you in.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Clunkily bring my laptop out. Thanks for being here, and thanks for thinking of me to read with Aishin, and thank you for, I love this podcast, which I got into about 3 months ago, but now I've listened to every single episode that there is.
I can't listen back to them.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm so emotional and flirty and all over the place.
But when you're listening back to them?
As you're listening back to them.
Just permanently. Yeah. Well, what I do like is the unpredictable chemistry of it. And as we've seen so far. Just like, it's just nice to, yeah. But I too cannot listen back to them. Mm. No.
Well, I'm very grateful for the very deep reading of Simulacrum you did on the two podcasts ago. And in that vein, I've actually thought I'm going to read a substitute one because I'll say it when I get there. But yeah, thank you for coming. I'm just going to read three poems from Strange Beach. I won't say much before the first two and then a little bit before the last one because it's a bit disconnected. So this one is called Fate. A lot of my titles are just like words that hopefully the poem is almost like a field in which the language of the poem is a field, moves inside the kind of field of the title. Mm. Fate. There's a man in a brownstone by a green. Field or not field. Strained meadow, more likely, blue blossoms tipping up like countrymen gone to a war they were never briefed on. Still fight, defend. Absolution of light, a uniform differentiating what's in from what's out. Purity, filth. Whoever decides cannot spell his name in piss across the other drips of an internal bile yellow pool draining his knees beneath. I guess there's a triumph to staying alive long enough to answer questions about fate, gravity, the bend downward. The resistance to bend downward, the blue blossoms lapels forming a shield. A room, nature containing them as if all along they had a say in the shut matter. Close your eyes, beloved. How else will you see what I will do in you? The second poem I'm going to read is from Simulacrum. There's a character, a man an imagined other, which happens a lot through his collection. It's just a he who is kind of an amalgam of all the he's that have existed in a way. But the same he from Simulacrum is the same he that I'm going to read this, is the same he who brought up this poem. It's originally called Siren. I considered retitling it to Greek Lesson After Anal, but I think Siren's a little more mysterious.
I disagree. Well, I think the other one says it carries a certain
mystery. The book is still in
flux.
I guess we can like we can think about it.
I'm on Jack's side.
You're going to Greek Lesson After Anal. We'll try it out. Greek Lesson After Anal.
I'm neutral.
You're neutral. Okay. Afterwards, please come let me know which one you liked more. Greek Lesson After Anal / Siren. Once a hookup described me as a siren luring him out to the ocean. He had the character's accurate, misunderstood, gravely, the vector of the dilemma. The siren's beauty was to charm consciousness out from Odysseus so that he'd cross the bottomless sparkling pool he thought was pleasure, consciousness, an underground fetish, rough sex, contemporarily abate. Also, drugs. Also, crowds. If Odysseus was diligent, he could have an orgy of all three. What man in his right mind wouldn't? Then again, however much fucking can seem to intimate returning home inside another man, we were not and never had been purely men. Even thinking me Penelope was a stretch. I wasn't a wife. I possessed negative reasons to wait. Odysseus, Odysseus, sang the sirens, though what they really meant was leave your ejaculate everywhere but where you target. Do you see? Tying himself to the mast was simply virtue signaling. The siren sung out towards that invisible part of him, what we now contemporarily call essence or urge. If you call me a siren, you are not being Lord. You are. If you come back, I am not a siren. I am that part of you. You will not harden. And then the last one I'm going to read is just kind of this end of a five-part poem that is about dying on a ski, which I've never been, which I've never done. Or on a mountain, which I've never been to. But it's a five-part poem about a skier who falls into the snow and his life flashes before him. And the part I'm gonna read for you is when the people, who are the people who help you in a tragedy?
Paramedics.
The paramedics, yes. The paramedics, this is the moment after there's kind of been this flash and then he gets consciousness back. Then the clamped pitter-patter of paws rearranging the flakes. Then the paramedics, as if they were always at hand, blares of red-blue light rising, snow breaking, barking, the invisible conductor commanding the scene return like a score to the outset, and his baton is infinite. Is impartial, waving behind the sky blur, coming into focus, the freezing body restarting a symphony of warmth, the gloves grabbing and lifting for a second in the surround, the eye, which has been frozen shut, peels open, and the trees begin to shake off the shower. The dark becomes a different type of dark. The blood resumes its work of searching, for openings into the world, light of van, no, light of ambulance, no, of savior, of he whose will this can be only, and distance vanishes into yellow light, and knees settle inches from the face, and the vehicle starts, and the soul, having not been completely revived, attempts the cadenza, lingers its smoke in the imprint, in the outline of your body that is already disappearing, melting, the dogs marching through it, the pens writing descriptions of absence, time hiding itself as the snow finds the first note and crescendos, and no one asks, oh, and this is a grace, what has happened here? Thank you.
Thank you so much. As you were reading, I was like, oh, okay, there are so many things now that I want to ask you both about textures and ambience and histories and male histories and also religion and bodies. But first, I think you've both bought talismans for us to have a look at. So usually on the podcast, we ask our readers to bring in a small object that exemplifies their writing process or means something to their writing process. And we've had a whole range of things before brought to us. And sometimes we've forgotten to tell the readers and we pretend that they've brought it to us. Mm. But this time, maybe we have real ones.
You've already had to do this once. Mm-hmm. So have you managed to cough up a new talisman? Or have you...
I've not managed to cough up a new one. But I on the way here, I was going to cut a sprig of rosemary from the entrance of the hotel. I noticed it. And because my writing desk at home is full of clutter, amongst the stuff on the desk, lots of branches and leaves and so on. So, but I forgot to do that. So I don't have the rosemary with me.
But it's good. We often pretend. We often just say, oh, it's here, but it's not. So, rosemary. Mm.
This is really behind the
curtain. Oh, sorry.
We shouldn't say
No, it's
this.
Always there.
I think, yeah. I was going to... I mean, you could... If you say that, then people could feel they could just bring anything and we'll have, like, a Frisian cow one series. Bringing that in.
What's a Frisian cow?
It's like a big milk cow, isn't it?
Normal cow.
Regular cow. No, Frisian.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, we have to... I think it's better to pretend, at least, to set some physical parameters. But anyway, you wouldn't want to bring a Frisian cow into the LRB bookshop. So what have you bought for us?
I brought these two rings that I have for the podcast people, I suppose, who will hear this in the future. One of them is a ring with skulls on it, with like black jewels. Mm. And the other one, I think this is like a normal, it's a very common sign. There's a name for it.
A fleur-de-lis, is that?
A fleur-de-lis.
I believe so.
A fleur-de-lis. Has it on that, and I guess its relation to my writing practice is I got them at a time. I got them 2 months before the pandemic began in a country on the Iberian Peninsula, and of which there are only two. And I guess this is to be anonymous. I don't know. Anyway, I got them on one of the countries on the Iberian Peninsula, and... basically, they were meant to be, they were, so basically I had been cheated on at that time, and I'd gone to visit my man at the time, who was on the Iberian Peninsula, and I thought he was going to get me a gift to, like, repair, you know, it's not really my love language, but I thought, like, okay, well, he'll give me, you know, it'll be a gesture that will make everything okay, which is obviously just the structure that you need to believe, which is not true. Anyway, so we get to the ring shop. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna get these rings. I start looking. He's like, oh, choose which one you want. And I start looking, and I get them. I get these two, and then I go to like the counter, and I start doing the thing where you like look away, and you know, you're like, oh, this is gonna be, and then like I'm turning around, and there's no kind of. There's nothing happening. Like I'm turning away, and they're not being paid for. And then basically, and then I got really upset. I was like, wait, I thought this was you were meant to show me you loved me through this.
He gave you the gift of going to a shop.
He gave me, yeah. Essentially, we had a nice South African cuisine later. That was fine, but at that moment, I. He was like, but he did say, which is, and I'm going to bring this back because there's writing in this. He said, like, you're going to be so happy that you bought these for yourself. And in that moment, yeah, okay, we can talk about this a little bit after. But in that moment, I was so upset. But obviously, I brought him. They're nice. So I spent like, it wasn't a crazy amount of money, but it was like a lot of money for me at the time. And then broke up over it years ago. And now I actually, with that time, I am actually really glad I bought them for myself. But this way this comes into my writing practice is that like that need of time to like have the both the perspective of feeling like there is meant to be this kind of like third skin that was going to heal us because he bought it for me, which in that moment it could have been, it wasn't, but it could have been. And then also the after of that kind, like that perspective that happens. And I think this comes back to writing, that like, often that's how I work with my poems as well, because I'm not really a good tinkerer. I'm not like I'm quite an ecstatic person. I'm just gonna get it all out on the page and then I'll forget about it, usually for months, and then I'll change or another thing will happen, and then I'll like, with that time in between, I'll be able to see whether it's, you know, needs to be aborted, whether it needs to be cut, whether maybe it is finished and I just am done with that, or if it needs to be kind of, you know, slashed for parts and absorbed into the new poem I'm writing at that time.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about bodies and male bodies and your work as a choreographer and a dancer and the kind of dynamics and the dynamism of your work that feels like it travels through and in and out of bodies and spaces and erotics in a way that feels so external and so internal, so domestic and so mapped onto landscape and ecologies. And I guess this is more of a comment, not a question, but...
It's our podcast, we can do it when we like.
How do you feel like... I feel like when I'm reading your poems and when you read them, I feel like there's such physicality and there's such movement. And I love speaking to people who have various disciplines and those disciplines feed into each other. And I wondered about that kind of cerebral, somatic, physical relationship that you bring into the work.
Well, I think it's rhythm, as I think like what Aishin was saying, it is rhythm is a really big part of my work. And I think when I was starting to write, which I still am starting to write, I think I only started writing like 5 years ago, but really like started thinking about really poetry as a way of existing like 3 years ago. So I'm still very much at the beginning. But I remember I felt like I think there was a long time where I thought to be a poet of the body and a dancer meant I just have to list the body in the poem. And that would make it a poem of the body, which I'm only now coming out of under, like, you know, being a, like, you know, the word thorax happens a lot, torso, hands, which is, I mean, that's kind of generally happens in a lot of poetry. But there is a lot of descriptions of, like, anatomy. But I don't necessarily know if that makes it a kind of physiological thing. I think a lot about, I think it's Gregory Orr, The Four Temperaments, where he talks about, like, music is that thing that goes straight to the heart. And, like, that for me is, for me now, what I'm conceptualizing is kind of, like, poetry of the body. If you can get inside someone else's kind of, almost like you're disrupting their kind of circadian rhythm with the rhythm that you're transmitting from your poems, like you're essentially trying to send this like vibration into them. And if you can get them on your wavelength, essentially, then that for me is a physiological type of, is a kind of physiological endeavor. I think there's a lot of poetry that mentions the body, but it doesn't actually go inside it. And so I think rhythm for me, as I'm going through my poems, and I say rhythm, and you know, I don't have a super big experience like doing, you know, kind of prosodic analysis of my poems. It really is just kind of what sounds true, what sounds kind of, you know, the beginning of that like Greek lessons after anal. So he had the characters accurate, but he must. It's all that kind of like jostling around in kind of rhetoric until you land somewhere else, and that kind of pushing and pulling.
Do you think that, yeah. that a lot of the time when poets also do something else, whether they're a musician or an actor, mm. or there's always, like, people are always keen to have, like, that analogy. What's the difference or what's yeah. the same? Mm. And I sort of feel like, I'm not going to do that now, don't worry. There's no, but I do think that in the sort of the imaginary world of your poems, there is this kind of like intuitive sense that oh, maybe I could be doing this thing over here. Mm. And then like, and fighting against, as you're saying, with like the kind of almost like the comforting cliche or completion of like, of the ex buying the ring, mm. yeah. resisting that. And like the way in which dance is also kind of like a resisting of the mannerism mm. in favor of something more intuitive mm-hmm. And mm. spontaneous. And that, mm. that constant kind of, back and forth. Oh no, did I just do a dance poetry analogy? Maybe I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. Oh well.
It worked.
It was okay.
This I like bringing the idea of the body back to sound. Mm. And I think about one of my favorite pamphlets by Sylvia Legree called Pneumatic Antiphonal, where she's writing about bird song, but kind of using the biological processes of the human throat and lungs and the bird body to kind of indicate the processes that go towards making noise from the body. Mm-hmm. And it does link me to, I think, what you're doing in School of Instructions as well, which is this kind of, you know, the mud poem is just so evocative and mm-hmm. so bodily. And there is a kind of, you know, we do have sound systems within us that we aren't necessarily privy to and that are just occurring in us and grumbling away and beating away. Before I carry on, I have to do a time check because we are
quarter past eight.
Running over.
Yeah.
Would you like to read us a poem to finish? Because yeah. I think we're probably at the end, right?
Could we hear the mud poem?
Maybe.
Aishin, could you do a request?
Sure. If I mean, do people have the stamina to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I have it? They shoveled the long trenches day and night. Frostbitten mud, shell shock mud, dung heap mud, imperial mud, venereal mud, malaria mud, Hunbait mud, mating mud, 1655 mud, white flashes of sharks, Golgotha mud, Chilblain mud, Caliban mud, cannibal mud, ha 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 mud, amnesia mud, dryptomania mud, lice mud, pyrexia mud, exposure mud, aphasia mud, no man's lands, every man's mud, and the smoking flax mud, dysentery mud, septic sore mud, hogpen mud, nephritis mud, constipated mud, fate mud, sandfly fever mud, rat mud, sheol mud, Air Hasheries mud, Ajib mud, Asquith mud, Parade mud, Scabies mud, Mums mud, Memra mud, Pneumonia mud, Menemenitekel Apartion mud, Civil War mud, and darkness and worms will be their dwelling place mud, Yaz mud, Gog mud, Magog mud, God mud, Canaan the unseen as promised saw mud. They resurrected new counter kingdoms by the arbitrament of the sword mud.
And maybe we'll finish with a poem.
I'm going to read a poem called Routine. It's about being an American in a country where you have healthcare. Just by virtue of being here, which is seems like a crazy concept. Yeah. Routine. You should recognize me. The questionless vista, a morbid geography of borders declining, collapse, instant shock. In their decline, I am drying sweat. Call me unfamiliar blister, white blood cell party of rise and scar. Expired ointment to treat. I am a feared life, an unencumbered promise, twisting its gold nail down the spine like a law. A skylight at the doctor's office radiates through an octagonal roof. What inquiry do we die for? The ears of the mouth are where? Think of sickness as a smaller life, trying to escape and take you prisoner as courtesy. A friend is investigative, asks earnestly in her dog voice, what is it about England? Its thousand-year bell ring, its bronze cast, its ear punch. I say, as if answers have ever contained correctitude. Healthcare. I mean Alpha and Omega, the eternal promise pact of religion, the situation, an unexamined lump in the psyche. Are you malignant, born badly? I'm an injury you woke up with, you saw coming. My country, a worn ligament. Hope, a money I can't afford. Pray nimbly, as if we're given 9 lives. A child with an accent I wish I could mute, opens his mouth, and his mother cares, pills she's shaking in her expensive manicure. Little things, can they not be made perfect? The doctor, merchant of minutes. How many bushels will keep me in this dimension? Division, the fast form of subtraction. How quick we find our relation to disappearance. She's good at her job of elongating. I hustle the improvised monologue of my ailments in her walled direction. She is the listening kind, hears flags in my voice. I can't say I'm scared of dying. Will this rash go away? Must be good enough. Must pierce the bare palm of her brain. She clicks a button on my existence. Lay on your side so I can glove the problem, she says. If you get your hands in a thing, don't let go. This is not the chorus of creation, keeping today as one long tomorrow. Catch the flying song. What if anxiety were a melody? Oh no, a rip in the sail. Thank you.
Thank you so much to our incredible guests, Aishan and Oluwashan. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you and hear you read. Thank you, everybody, so much for staying over time. You are now free to go. And thank you to all our listeners who will be listening to this in the future or your present.
Yeah.
Thank you.